So this is the second talk in the course, and the title, I want to give it some lightness. Piglet was digging in the garden, and Pooh arrived behind his back. And Piglet said to Pooh, "I knew it was you." And Pooh said, "So did I." So I do think that we need to be quite light about the whole issue of self and non-self. Light, relaxed, friendly, humorous. I have a book in my library, Tibetan translation, this fat on emptiness. It's really this big. Ooh. When I start to read it, and I started a few times, wow. So full, so much to say on emptiness, it's crazy. So I want to just really give it some basis in the Buddhist teaching to kind of ground the sense of self and non-self in the bigger and classical Buddhist teaching. So the classical teaching is, of course, the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is that we cannot avoid dissatisfaction once we're born in a body. Doesn't matter whether it's a human being or an ant. There will be dissatisfaction because both a human being and an ant spends most of their lives trying to stay alive. So it's a life of struggle. To be fed, looked after, etc. And it's important to understand that the first noble truth is not about life. It's about our reactions to being in a body. Life isn't suffering. Life is just life. But we get dumped in a body. Boom. So, the good news is that the suffering and difficulty that we've experienced, many of us here in this retreat, in our life, and we see it around us everywhere, it's not absolute. It's not cast engraved in stone. The suffering is fed. We feed the suffering. We feed the stories that give us trouble. We give them support. So imagine a psychological issue that we have, a story that goes round and round that gives us a lot of trouble. We have fed that story in some way. It's not part of our DNA, that story. It's arrived, yes, it feels stuck, but because we fed it, we gave it investment. So attachment is actually good news, because suffering is the result of attachment, second noble truth. And the word for attachment in Pali is upadana. And upadana is giving fuel to the fire. So what happens if we just don't give fuel to the fire? We don't suffer. We just stop giving fuel. And that means things are much more flexible than we thought. They're not there, stuck. I'm forever stuck. I'm thinking of cancer patients that we work with over many, many years. And yes, there were quite a few cancer patients that felt really stuck with their disease and the suffering that involved and the loss of capacity and bodily symptoms. But there were some cancer patients that actually decided not to feed that image of themselves and that issue and that narrative, I have cancer. And I remember, you know, one or two cases where one of the participants in weekend said, "I don't care a damn about my cancer. It's not interesting to me. I'm painting, I'm drawing, I'm with grandchildren, I'm walking by the sea. The cancer is not interesting to me. And that's an example of non-feeding. No fuel to the fire of our suffering. So attachment has four aspects in the classical teaching. The first is the senses. And the senses are very clear. We need something, we want something, we want more. We delight in something, we are against something, we don't want this, we do want that. And the senses are a whole territory of attachment. And we can obviously feel that in our life. When we get up in the morning, what do our senses tell us and what do we do with it? Where do we go with that? With those senses that tell us, go there, do that. That's better, that's comfortable, that's not comfortable. The second of the four is called sila. And it's a sense of the way things should be. A sense of control. A sense of the way society is. I remember my mother, she had a phrase that annoyed me a bit. She said, I said, why do we need to do this? And she kept saying, because one does. One does that, meaning one, the society, I don't know who she means, but one does that. And, well, and there's a lot of pain in that. It goes very far. I was discussing today with Radha the role of women in the monasteries, in the Theravada tradition and also Tibetan tradition. And there's major, major issues there, and major inequality and major suffering of women in the monastic community. So it's not just in Islam or in Christianity or in other faiths, in Buddhism too. Have a sense of attachment to the way things should be, usually run by males and patriarchal and controlling. The third, attachment to views. Views. And this is really interesting because we can never know the truth about anything. In the big picture, we can never say, I know the truth and they're wrong. I am right and they're wrong. That language doesn't work in a spiritual or Dharma context. The views that we, the way we look at the world through our mind is just a view. It's just the way I look at the world. I can't say that my view is 100% correct and others are not. And it's quite important to actually come down off the tree where we keep thinking, well, that's a fact. That's a fact. And this is a fact. And that's absolutely right. And that's a fact. There really aren't such things as facts. There are views. Every thought is a view. Every single thought is a view. So attachment to views, turning them into beliefs and facts, is a third one. And the fourth one is the belief in self. So the way it's described is belief in self. And that's quite an interesting way to describe. Attachment to self is attachment to belief. Because we actually don't see it. We believe it. And we can think, you know, how much it emerges and how much pain there is in it. And think of conflict. Think of 100 years of conflict in this area of the world, Palestinians and Israelis. How much that comes from a belief in self. I deserve this, I need that, I have to have that. They don't need, they. And how much pain that creates. Or voices in us that believe in me. I am sick. My body. My disease. Is it my disease? Or is it disease coming from the world? My conditions. I mentioned the eight worldly winds. People like me, people don't like me. Success, failure. Our whole life is built around running after this belief in self. Self-judgment, self-criticism. Story in the mind that I'm good, I'm better, I'm not good. I could be better, I need to be better. I was better, now I'm not better. And it goes into the spiritual life as well, which is very natural. The belief in self goes into the spiritual life and creates measuring. I came to the retreat in order to get this. I need this. And it's not happening, or it's happening half. So I'm disappointed. But there's a measuring in there of what I want to get out of the retreat and how much I got there. So it goes very subtly into spiritual life as measuring. So we can cut through attachment by opening a little window. And there's a very nice image of the self in the tradition, that the self is a king in a castle. And he thinks he's the king of everything. But he doesn't realize he's actually imprisoned in his own castle. So he's sitting there feeling really good on his throne in the middle of the castle. And all of a sudden a small bird comes in through a window high up in the wall of the castle. And the bird has two wings. And one wing is calm and one wing is insight. One wing is samadhi, samatha. And one wing is vipassana, insight. And it's the beginning of his freedom. So when we open a window to our attachments, they begin to dissolve, they become less fed, they become less believed, they become less serious, they become less total. Mindfulness, as the truth of the moment, should understand that one of the important things about mindfulness, is that it is less processing. So we process less, process the world. So processing means something happens, and processing is developing perception, conclusion, interpretation, selfing, the way things are built up from a moment of experience. But mindfulness, the important aspect of mindfulness is it cuts through that. There's less processing. We allow things, we acknowledge them, we allow visitors, and we let them go. And this way we don't feed our suffering anymore. Things just arrive and we let them go. So one of the results of that is that we begin to see things more phenomenology, like phenomena. The Buddha said, it's all right if you say and feel and think and know there is a body. Just like it's raining. There is a body. You don't need to go the next stage. My body, it has its problems, it has its issues, I want something better for it. There is a body. So, at the heart of experience, the truth of a deeper truth in the heart of experience that frees us are the three characteristics or the three marks. And I just want to go through them. Many of you know them already, but they're such classical Buddhist teaching behind everything we're doing. So the first is dukkha, meaning the first noble truth of pain. And we need to see how we give ourselves trouble. We need to see it. Here we are, minding our own business, doing nothing, sitting quietly, and up comes some kind of demons from the unconscious and problems we thought we dealt with 10 years ago, and itch in the back, and the body starts paining, and oh, I'm just sitting here quietly. Why does it happen? I'm not disturbing anybody. So when we need to see that's the way things happen. Thought going round bugs us. We feel it's bugging me. It's a nuisance. I want it to stop. If we look at it as dukkha, already there is a small relief. Because if we look at it as dukkha, dukkha is not ours, actually. It's just because of the fact of embodiment. We're arriving in a body. It's about samsara. It's about us and the world. And we can actually feel, okay, dukkha is happening, but I don't need to take it so personally. And that can help us. It's just the nature of things. And we will see also that more ownership, more trouble. It's just a rule of life. The more we are owning our experience, it's me, it's happening to me, subjective, the more we're going to suffer. It's just the way things are. If you think about it, any experience that we have, the more we own it and call it mine and it's in me and I want to fix it and I want to change it, and the more suffering there will be. But far less suffering in there is a body. There is a body. So dukkha is always a teacher. It shows us where to look in our meditation. So I don't say that we shouldn't have a great time. And we're sitting peacefully and quietly. And we don't need the thought that says, oh, if I don't have dukkha, I don't progress. We don't need that. We can feel kusala, the wholesomeness of joy, of calm, of peace. We can just feel good with qualities that are helpful to us indeed. But when we're sitting quietly in peace and joy, and up comes a hell of a chain of thought that gives us real trouble, we need to look at that. We need to stop. We need to see, okay, here's dukkha. Dukkha is showing me where I need to dig. Like someone once said, dukkha is like an X on the map of Treasure Island that says, dig here. If you dig there in dukkha, you'll understand your limit, because the dukkha, understanding dukkha, is where we purify our conscious and our unconscious mind. So we do need to see dukkha as a teacher. Yes, it's not pleasant sometimes. Pain in the back. How do I see that as a teacher? It's just a pain in the back. I want to stop. I want to lie down. But actually, if we see it as a teacher, the pain in the back, we begin to open the box. We begin to see our relationship with what is uncomfortable and painful. We begin to see if there's other ways of looking at this pain. We begin to feel our independence of that pain and our freedom, even though there's a back pain. We begin to notice our reactivity. And all these are important insights that dukkha invites us. Say you're in the street, Tel Aviv, New York, San Francisco, and you're in conflict with somebody. So as soon as you begin, maybe you need to take a breath, just to kind of shift the track, shift the automatic. As soon as you take a breath and say, wait a minute, there's dukkha happening here, I'm in conflict with somebody, you watch the reactivity that you are generating, you watch your contracted place, which is you against somebody, you watch the self that you're manifesting, you watch the self of the other person, you watch what happens, you watch the buttons that are pressed inside you, you watch the words that are coming out, you watch the thoughts. The whole thing opens out. You may still shout. Okay, it happens. We're not pretending to be perfect beings. But dukkha has invited you to really unpack something which is closed and stuck and painful, called a conflict with somebody that just bursts out with anger and reactivity and goes nowhere and just makes us feel bad. So that's the difference. Dukkha invites us. A second place, a mark, is anicca. And anicca, we talked about it, and we always talk about it. And it's like everything's made of clouds. And we're trying to hang on to the clouds and make them solid. I need this, I need that. And when we see that all the clouds are moving through our fingers, a thought is a cloud, a thought is passing by. Can we really see a thought? Can we really catch a thought? Very difficult, because it's so fast. It comes and goes, it changes to something else. Anicca challenges changeability. The Buddha said, all compounded things are impermanent. Compounded means everything in this universe is made of other things. And they're all impermanent, because they're all made of other things. Our body is made of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, water, etc. So clearly, all these elements go back. Water goes back to water. Just when you go and do pee-pee right now, water goes back to water. It doesn't stay. So memory tends to give the illusion of fixation. And often we want to fix our memories. We don't like our memory. We want to be somebody else. So I'd like to read a little piece from my book in the English version. And just as a reflection on this issue of anicca and the shape that we're in when we arrive in this moment. We might ask how it is possible not to identify with memory if it forms who we are and our individuality. Indeed, memory is a form of shaping. I live alongside lots of olive trees, which have an amazingly expressive character, which clearly shows everything that has happened to them. If a branch has been cut, or if the tree reaches out in a certain direction, or there are lumps on the trunk, you can see it. The shaping of the tree is its memory, a response to conditions. And the tree doesn't have a problem with that. And there is no reason why we should have a problem either. We are also just shaped, constructed by life. We are given a body, and it develops and changes dynamically according to conditions. And we arrive in each moment as we are, and the world arises and meets us as it is. And all we need to do is to appreciate it and let it be. Stories are just stories, narratives are just narratives, and embodiment is just embodiment. If we let go into this flow of life, the wounds will dissolve, the scars will be softened and brought back to life, and we will find ourselves in the garden of the now, instead of the prison of yesterday's. A difficult experience can come up, just like an unpleasant visitor arriving in our house. We can cry, but the next minute we can laugh, and then he's gone. So we need to get close to our experience. Thought seems like a stream of consciousness, just going round and round, telling us about the to-do list we have and what we need to do next week and what I think about this and what I think about that. Actually, if we get close to consciousness, it's nothing but bubbles passing by. If we get close to a thought and we look at it carefully, it's just a bubble passing by. We can't hold on to any experience. Think of how much you would try to hold on to this great experience, like piece of the best chocolate cake. How can you hold on to anything? So one place that we can experience this is to change the resolution. Now, supposing we're walking, and we're walking outside. So there is a middle ground. I am walking, I'm thinking, this is me, and that's kind of the middle size, me. High resolution, pixelim, is like what my toes are doing. What's the touch of my feet? The little stones on the earth. There's very little me needed for that. The other resolution, the big resolution, is also not much me. The connection with the trees and the sky and everything else. So one of the ways we can practice is actually changing the resolution. And if we do that, we begin to see that this self is a kaleidoscope. This me is a kaleidoscope of millions of impulses and impressions, and we collect impressions and build out of it a story and an identity. But it's all made up of other things and dissolves as it arises. I remember in my a degree exam in Oxford University in biochemistry, one of the questions was, how many molecules of Caesar's last breath are you breathing each time you breathe one breath? There's a whole list of details and numbers. How many molecules of Caesar's last breath? So anatta, the third of the three marks or the three characteristics, is anatta. And it helps us to understand that we add ownership to our experience. Our experience is actually, there is a body. Hand is saying, I'm here. Fingers are saying, I'm alive. On top of that, the attachment to self adds a layer called my hand, my body. So ownership is added all the time to experience. It's not necessarily inherent in experience. It's added to experience. It colors our experience. And we keep making the self. It's not a thing that we can kind of meet. The self is a verb, not a noun. It's a process, not a thing. We can watch the arising and passing of the self and how it's so tricky and not really clear and defined. It's just an automatic process of attachment. Just think, when you go to a restaurant, you think about it. I want this meal, this is great. I want one of those. Look at the menu and you're full of self. That one is good and that one is not good, and this one is great and this one is not. So when we make choices, we say, that's me, I like that one. And there's lots of ownership in that. But supposing we eat the meal, is there any ownership of the digestion? The same meal. But once it's gone in the body, we lost interest. It's not, my meal is here and I asking for my digestive system to do a good job. And no, it's just not even interesting to us anymore. So the self only goes to a certain limit, and then we forget it. And never mind the shit that comes out the other end. We don't want to say, oh, my shit is in the toilet. I want it back. I don't want to lose it. We need to keep watching the arising and passing of self. Keep watching the dynamic nature of self. Keep watching how it pops up, disappears, is limited, stops, starts. If we deeply relax, there's less of a self. But if immediately someone takes my cup, there's a big time self. So what's the experience of that? So it's, again, I have to keep reminding everybody, don't get stuck on no self. That's not the way. We're talking about attachment and undoing, not feeding the self, not feeding the belief in self. That's working with attachment. But if we start believing in non-self, we're stuck in another place. And then we need to write these fat books on emptiness. And we can feel very, very stuck. So we can keep seeing that here. Anatta is one of the three characteristics. And if it works for us, we can explore it. There's a breath. Who's in control? Who's running the show? Who's running this breath? Who's controlling this breath? Is there control? Or is it doing itself? Or both? These are exploring, these are fields of exploration which bring us to close to anatta. So less processing, less is less selfing and less attachment and less suffering. Processing meaning building things out of, building sankharas out of impressions and out of the senses. So we kind of need to know that the senses themselves are pretty clean. They don't really have a self sitting there at the door of the ears and the nose. They're doorways to the world. There's less illusion in the senses. They're more direct. And if we get close to the senses, our sensory connection to the world, doorways to the world that we feel, the leaf on the tree and the foot walking and the breath moving and the body touching and all those this sensory world, there is a joy in that because it's less processed. It's less constructive. It's less, we've done less with it. We've built less out of it. So we're really trying to kind of go to a place where there's more joy and we're dancing with the world through the senses. Every moment the senses say something different and it's a dance. There's a lot of freedom in that. There's a nice quote from the Buddha in the Sutta Nipata about this. The Buddha said, for some people, contact, the point where senses meet an object, is captivating. And so they are washed by the tides of being, drifting along an empty, pointless road. But others come to understand their sense activity, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. And we're just going to feel that. We understand our sense activity and there is stillness. Just a sense of being with the world. No construction, no need to add anything. So I want to finish with a small story that many of you know called the Bahia Sutta, which does talk about senses in a very interesting way. So Bahia was a yogi living in the south of India, and very much ascetic, and his clothes only made of the bark of trees. One night, he had a certain doubt. All the villagers tell me I'm enlightened, but I'm not sure. Am I really enlightened? I need to check it out. So he kind of invited the gods to tell him, and the gods said, no way, you're not at all enlightened. So he said, well, what do I do? They said, go to the north of India, 3,000 miles, and see the Buddha, and he'll help you. So Bahia began a trek. He's non-stop, running, kind of, it says every day. He never stayed 2 days in one place. He was constantly walking, from the south to the north, where the Buddha was teaching. And when he got to the Buddha's area, he found the Buddha, and the Buddha was collecting food in his bowl. The Buddha said to him, look, I can't talk to you now. He said, but you must. It's urgent. I've come 3,000 miles. I have to get an answer now. The Buddha said, I'm sorry, but I don't teach now. I'm collecting food. After lunch, we're going to go to my place, and there I'll teach you. No, it must now. You have to teach me now. I don't have time. So the Buddha said, oh, okay, well, if you ask me three times, I have no choice. But I'll make it short. And he said, in the seeing, just be with seeing. There's just seeing. In the hearing, there is just hearing. In the smelling is just smelling. In the touching is just touching. In the tasting is just tasting. And in the thinking is just thinking. And when you understand the senses are just seeing, hearing, thinking, then there's no self there. There's no self here. You are not a self here. There's no self there when you see and hear something else out there. There's no self in between the two. And that's liberation. And the next minute, he was enlightened and killed by a runaway cow. And those of you who have been in the alleys of Varanasi are going to know how problematic it is when you meet a buffalo in an alley that's the size of this, and there's a buffalo coming to you, kind of. You really need to get out of the way. So he was killed by a cow, but he was awakened. And the Buddha asked the monks, this man is awakened, bury him with the arhants, with awakened ones. But the teaching is very important. In the seeing, that's it. There's just seeing. There's no need to build processing of a seer and an object and what needs to happen and the constructions. In the hearing is just hearing. And it's what we're practicing here. It's what is basically our practice. To get close, to get intimate with the lived moment through our senses. Very simple, very clean. Not needing a lot of me in charge of that. Thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.